Good evening. This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday night, May 20th, 2020. Ahead this evening, even in an economic slowdown, you don't have to have dull knives. The business of knife sharpening ahead in our second half hour. And we'll continue the national conversation tonight after this evening edition of Ozarks at Large. Every weeknight, All Things Considered and NPR producing a live hour of radio dedicated to the latest news regarding the virus, as well as providing answers to your questions. The national live conversation begins at 8 tonight. Arkansas's cumulative number of COVID-19 cases now more than 5,000. Dr. Nate Smith, Arkansas's Secretary of Health, says there are 1,044 active cases in the state. 644 of those are considered community cases. In the last 24-hour monitoring period, 80 new cases were reported, 79 of which are considered community cases. Dr. Smith says there were 113 recoveries during that same monitoring period. He led today's press briefing while Governor Asa Hutchinson met with President Trump and Vice President Pence in Washington, D.C. Dr. Smith says there were 5 new deaths over the last 24 hours because of the virus. That brings the statewide total to 107. He also says the state's testing continues to increase. Monday, the state recorded a new high of 3,000 tests. And yesterday, Dr. Smith says, the state conducted even more.
Yesterday, we broke that again with 4,396 tests. So you can see a big spike there. Of those tests, 1.9% were positive, so still a relatively low positivity rate.
Arkansas has now conducted more than 44,000 tests this month in an effort to reach 60,000 tests conducted by the end of May. Much of today's briefing included information about safe workplaces as reopenings continue. Dr. Smith says keeping businesses safe so they can remain open is a critical part of the slow reopening process.
Businesses have to stay open. To do that, they have to have workers coming in, not being afraid that they're going to be infected. And they have to have, if they have customers as well who come onto their site, their customers also have to be confident that they're not at risk of infection. And so safe work sites are an essential part, not only of controlling COVID-19 spread in our communities and saving lives, but also a very important part of our economy recovering from the impact of COVID-19.
Dr. Jennifer Dillehay, the state epidemiologist, says if an Arkansan tests positive for COVID-19, that result is reported to the Arkansas Department of Health, and the patient is then interviewed.
Part of the interview is to learn about when did they first develop symptoms, because we're interested in learning when their infectious period was. So we take that from the day they develop symptoms, and then we back up 2 days, because the thinking is that people can spread the virus when they're pre-symptomatic, during the couple of days before they actually develop symptoms. So the nurse would interview them and learn about who is in their household that might have been exposed.
And she says if the patient has been to work, her or his employer is contacted, so close work contacts can then be identified and further tested.
And excluded from work because they need themselves to be under quarantine. There are some situations where if a person is in a position of critical infrastructure or an essential worker, it's possible they may continue to work.
Information for summer camps and team sports in Arkansas moving ahead was originally intended to be shared today. But with the governor at the White House, those announcements are delayed until tomorrow, though Dr. Smith says some of the decisions have been shared with some overnight camp officials in the state. You can follow how the virus is affecting this region and state at the COVID-19 page at KUAF.com and through our morning newscast every Monday through Friday at 5:30 and 7:30 a.m. with Antoinette Grajeda. The Northwest Arkansas Council announced today it will award grants to 23 local arts and cultural nonprofits through its Bridge Fund program. The funds are to be used for transition planning and support activities, including developing new business models, new paradigms, programs, staffing models, infrastructure to take programming online, and reimagining creative production. A list of the 23 organizations receiving funds can be found at nwacouncil.org. This is Ozarks at Large. Restaurants, hotels, nightclubs, hospitals. The list of industries damaged by the economic halt because of the pandemic is long. And we can add local media outlets. Advertising revenue for many local papers, radio stations, and TV outlets shrinking as the social distancing continues in some form in most states. And news services are feeling the burden. There could be legislative help. Last week, several senators, including Arkansas Senator John Bozeman, co-sponsored a bipartisan financial package that still has to wind its way through both chambers in Washington, D.C. Helping lead the effort to convince lawmakers the assistance is vital is John Schlois, the president of News Guild. It's a union devoted to media entities. John is a former Arkansas resident and former voice you heard several years back on KUAF and Ozarks at Large. Last week, we reached him at his Washington, D.C. home to ask about the News Guild, a sector of the Communication Workers of America.
The Communications Workers of America is about 450,000 members across the United States and Canada. At the News Guild, we represent about 24,000 journalists, other media workers, including nonprofit staffers and staffers at other unions. The bulk is journalists, and we represent people both in the U.S. and in Canada. A lot of our work is spent organizing new workers, so adding new members to our union, which has been happening in record numbers. In 2018, we had 1,400 people decide that they wanted to join our union. Mm. We beat that record in 2019 with 1,500 people adding to our roles. And then this year, even more people are wanting to join, especially because of the pandemic, because a lot of people, a lot of journalists, are trying to find ways to save their newsrooms. And a lot of these chains are controlled by private equity and hedge funds, which resulted in a lot of cuts and job losses. So people are starting to fight back.
Let's talk about newspapers first. I mean, these were not glory days before the pandemic for many newspapers, if any. What has the pandemic meant for journalists and editors and people who work for newspapers?
Well, it's done a couple things. The first is that it's accelerated the rapid decline in revenue from print advertising. Back when I was at the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, we used to say that for every dollar of revenue generated, 90 cents came from print revenue. That's radically different today, but still a huge chunk of revenue comes from advertising revenue that appears in printed newspapers. It's being offset by increases in digital subscriptions, which has been a hopeful sign. But they're not happening fast enough. And then at the same time that all the advertising revenue is being depleted, people all across the country are depending on local news to know what's happening in their community, how many cases or how many deaths, where can they get tested, which businesses are open, and what are the requirements by the local authorities, which the situation is extremely local. So it's become not only the largest news story, but it's also an extremely local news story. And journalists and editors are working at a rapid pace to continue reporting stories happening all over the place. And there's a lot of exhaustion at this moment for a lot of journalists because they're running against never-ending deadlines to constantly share life-saving news.
Yeah, it's just a horrible irony that at the time when so many people are really relying on local newspapers, local radio stations, local TV stations, local outlets, that these local outlets are having to struggle perhaps the most they have in recent memory, if not longer, with finances. What sort of help can be provided?
Well, the first thing that people can do is contribute, become a contributing member to KUAF, or subscribe to their local newspaper or news publication. I think that's the key, right? If you can get people to support it, I mean, right now, that is a huge benefit to keeping local stories continue to flow. The second thing that is important and what we're really engaged on, and is a place I didn't imagine myself to be as a, you know, as a former journalist, union president, is lobbying members of Congress to support the news industry and keep people employed during this pandemic, because it's a matter of public health. It's also a matter of saving our democracy, because heading into an election, not just at the national level, but at the local level, people need to know about the issues. They need to know what's happening in their communities and who's running for different races. And, you know, we're continuing to expose corruption and tell positive stories even through this pandemic. So we're actively lobbying members of Congress, and we're asking people to write in, telling their senator or their representative to support news workers during this pandemic, because it's life-sustaining information that we need now more than ever.
What kind of reaction are you getting from lawmakers?
Surprisingly positive. When we started this effort back in early April, we released a plan, a 9-point plan, and there was no one in Congress who was calling for support for journalism, whether local or national. And now we've got hundreds of members of Congress calling for something. So that could be pushing the federal government to increase its advertising spending that's already allocated in many department budgets, or directed grants to keep people employed for at least the rest of the year, or an expansion of the Small Business Administration Paycheck Protection Program, which allows small businesses to apply for loans to keep people employed during this pandemic. But a lot of newspapers have been cut out of it because they employ, you know, more than the threshold for declaration as a small business. So we're pushing for change, and both Republicans and Democrats in both chambers are calling for an expansion that would allow newspapers chains to be able to apply based on the specific location, so that the funds would be directed to the location and not go to headquarters. That's really essential. And you're seeing like Senator Bozeman support that effort too.
Yeah, that was late last week when he signed on to this bipartisan bill. What specifically is included in that legislation?
So the specifics would be that it would allow an exemption for companies that classify themselves as newspapers, radio stations, or TV stations to be able to apply, while showing a requirement that they actually need the money, be able to apply for those loans to help support payroll for the next several weeks, potentially month. And it's a separate standalone bill at the moment. Of course, the House also introduced its own legislation and voted on it last week as well, which included a lot of the similar things. So it's going to just take some now maneuvering between the two chambers on actually getting a bill passed. But likely some form of this, and this is what we're pushing for and others are as well, some form of this will make it into the next relief package to make sure journalists continue to stay on the job during this pandemic.
You know, when I asked what kind of reaction you're getting from lawmakers, and I think the word you said was surprisingly, and I think that's because, you know, over the last few years, not everyone has regarded journalists as important. And I just wonder if you've heard any of the tenor, if you've heard anyone say that, you know, you're working for a union that's the enemy of the people or anything like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, we definitely have a president tweet that, you know, that at journalists, you know, that we're the enemy of the people. But at the local level, you know, it's the exact opposite. I mean, we don't know what's happening in our communities without journalists covering them. You know, we don't know about a corrupt mayor. We don't know about misspending, mishandling of public funds by county officials. I mean, thinking back at my time there, you know, there was a county judge in Benton County who had used his own company to clean up the county-owned property using his own construction company after an ice storm. Mm-hmm. And it was a local reporter right there in Benton County who exposed that that form of corruption and, you know, ended up with the judge being kicked out of office.
I guess you're communicating with lawmakers through Zoom, through phone calls. You're not meeting them face-to-face, I would imagine.
No, I'm not. Even though I'm living in D.C. now, it's a lot of phone calls, a lot of Zoom calls, a lot of Google Meetup Hangouts, and a lot of that, and trying to get on their busy schedules. But it's been good. It's you know, a lot of them that I talk to are deeply concerned about it, whether they're Republican or Democrats, because they see especially local news as extremely essential in their communities.
Have you had a chance in all of this work to also talk to reporters and editors and owners of smaller local news outlets?
Yeah. I mean, that's a lot of my nights are talking to the leaders across our union. You know, we represent, as I said, thousands of journalists. We've got, you know, people in places like Casper, Wyoming, San Francisco, Milwaukee, Chicago, St. Louis, of course, New York City, but, you know, really all over the country. And they've been helping us come up with the ideas of, like, what we can do to try to save jobs now and also try to find a way to seed a future where we're growing news organizations that are more accountable to their communities rather than to shareholders or hedge funds. And I've also been talking to local newspaper owners, which has been surprising because generally, you know, labor unions don't tend to work too much with management, as we call it. But we are, because we're all in this fight together. We really want to save this industry and save the jobs, because we see it as essential to our democracy.
There's hardly an industry, I think, that won't be fundamentally changed whenever we're on the other side of this. But news organizations are going to be forever changed, I think. Don't you?
Oh, yeah. But I think that that's just part of our way of being, right? Like, if you break down, like, what we do, we're telling news stories, right? And sometimes that's in printed newspapers, and sometimes it's through radio waves getting to people in their cars or in their kitchens, or it's podcasts, or it could be e-graphics or photos or Twitter threads. I mean, we're constantly changing the medium, but the commodity is still the same. We're sharing information to people through news stories.
Anything I've forgotten to ask or that you'd like to add?
I miss being back in Arkansas. I wish I was there.
Well,
Arkansas is such a big part of my heart, and I miss it. I wish I was there.
Well, you've still got a lot of years in front of you. Perhaps you'll come back someday.
Yeah. Fix a few things first, and then maybe I can retire up there.
All right. Hey, it was wonderful hearing your voice. Please take care of yourself, and let's stay in touch, all right?
You too, Kyle. Thanks so much for having me.
John Schlois is the president of the News Guild sector of the Communication Workers of America, and he talked to us last week from his Washington, D.C. home. He's also a former announcer and reporter for KUAF and Ozarks at Large.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. When caring for a seriously ill loved one, the journey shouldn't be taken alone. Circle of Life Hospice can help. Services are covered by Medicare, Medicaid, and private insurance. No one is turned away based on an inability to pay. 750-6632 or nwacircleoflife.com for more.
This is Ozarks at Large. As restrictions start to be loosened on businesses, some nonprofits are easing restrictions on in-person volunteer opportunities. The Northwest Arkansas Food Bank, for example, is looking for volunteers to tend to its new teaching garden starting this week. To learn more, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda spoke via Zoom last week with Program Director Nina Evans.
So we broke ground on the garden in February of this year. So we've just had it about 3 or 4 months, so it's still very new. But the idea behind it was just that we wanted to be able to provide fresh local produce to the clients that we serve and also educate our partner agencies about growing their own food. So creating a garden on site seemed like the best way to do that.
And prior to the pandemic, were you able to have any volunteers help you out?
We were just about to have volunteers right when it all started. So not yet, but we hope to have them soon.
Who are you looking for in terms of volunteers? Do I have to be a gardener? Do I have to know what I'm doing?
Not at all. It's open to anyone who is interested, regardless of skill level. I can teach you whatever you need to know while you're out here. And we've got activities for all age ranges and skills. Currently, you just have to be over the age of 16.
What kind of precautions are you going to have to take because of the pandemic and social distancing?
So since the garden is outside, we're not going to require masks, which is great, but we are requiring social distancing of at least 6 feet. And then people have to bring their own tools and gloves, and there won't be any tool sharing or anything like that. So that's about it.
How many people will you have per shift?
We're going to have a maximum of 3 people per shift until the pandemic kind of winds down.
And how big is your garden? About how much land are you growing on, and what types of things are you growing?
Right. So this year it is about 1/4 acre total, so about 10,000 square feet. And we have squash, zucchini, watermelon, cantaloupe, bell peppers, potatoes, and a few onions is what we've got in this year.
And how do you envision distributing that?
All of the food grown in this garden will go to our mobile pantry program. And we have 13 mobile pantries each month across our four service areas. So the produce will just go directly to that program.
Why is it important for people to have access to fresh produce?
So food access to fresh produce is important for the overall health of our individuals and our communities. There's not only a lack of food access, but there's a lack of access to nutritious foods, since those foods are often more expensive. And that's just kind of the baseline for your overall well-being. So it's hard to have a healthy life if you can't have a healthy diet. So we're just trying to help people get that healthy base.
As things have been closed because of the pandemic, what has that been like for you in terms of volunteering? Have you had people reaching out asking how they can help?
We have had a lot of interest from volunteers, which there's been a lot of community support. Sadly, we haven't been able to accept those volunteers. So we're very excited to get our doors back open and to have people start coming in again.
So this is probably the first program that is starting to allow volunteers to come back in.
Yes, that's correct.
What are you looking for next? If this goes well, what might be another program that you'll be able to open up back to the public again?
So we're also going to look at doing mobile pantry volunteers. So like I was talking about earlier, those 13 locations throughout the four county area, we'll hopefully start welcoming volunteers back into that program and then also eventually back into the warehouse.
I've noticed there's been a lot of pop-up pantries posted online that you're hosting around the area. How has the pandemic affected food insecurity in the area? What have you noticed from your end?
It seems like there are a good deal, a higher number of people coming to our pantries. And we started the pop-ups to serve areas where food pantries had temporarily closed, to kind of fill those food desert areas. And there's definitely been a lot of interest in those. We've taken about 200 meals to each of those and usually run out of food. So I've noticed definitely more people coming by.
As businesses have started to reopen, have you noticed any lessening of a need yet, or are we still pretty early in those stages?
In certain areas, there has been a slight decrease in the number of clients that we've served, but overall, I'd say it's holding steady.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Nina Evans, Program Director at Northwest Arkansas Food Bank. She spoke via Zoom with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda last week. To register or to find more information about volunteer opportunities, you can visit nwafoodbank.org. Meanwhile, the Fayetteville Housing Authority is looking for sponsors to help the organization fund a garden project at its Hillcrest Towers property. Executive Director Angela Belford says they would like to build some raised plant beds for the residents of the building, especially now during the pandemic, which has highlighted the importance of creating community.
Having a garden kind of still creates community in a way that is social distanced. So it will allow us to be able to space the gardens apart right here in our courtyard and to give our residents an outlet. If we produce some great fruit food, then obviously that will be fantastic. But really, we're looking at the mental health aspects of growing your own food and how that helps you to have something to look forward to each day to take care of.
Belford says the garden beds will be built in such a way that allows residents who use wheelchairs or have other mobility issues easy access to the plots, with the added benefit of having access to an outdoor activity right outside their home, especially since housing at Hillcrest Towers is specifically reserved for elderly and disabled tenants.
We know that it is still for a long time going to be really unsafe for folks that are elderly and disabled to be able to be venturing out into the community. So bringing this ability to garden right here at home, essentially, we think is very important.
Belford says they're working with their resident engagement coordinator to find out how many residents are interested in using the gardening beds, and then they'll figure out the most fair and equitable way to get people involved.
So we're going to identify how many individuals are interested, if they would like to do the plot by themselves, and we'll kind of work with these first four to kind of develop the right operations that we need, whether it will be drawing from a hat, if there's a lot of interest.
As far as gathering seeds and plants for residents to plant in the garden beds, Belford says they already have a relationship with Tricycle Farms, and they plan to work with local landscaping companies, nurseries, and big box retailers to buy those supplies at a discount. You can find more information on becoming a sponsor for a garden bed by going to FayettevilleHousingAuthority.org. This is Ozarks at Large. We're checking in on businesses with specific audiences to find out how they're weathering the economic fallout. In our latest Business as Unusual Profile, Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich introduces us to Tyler Eck, operator of Honed In. He sharpens knives for a living.
Tyler Eck, wearing brown coveralls and a long beard, swirls a large dull kitchen knife in a 5-gallon bucket of bleach water this morning. Free from coronavirus, the knife's ready to be sharpened. Eck sharpens things for a living, from culinary knives to farm implements.
We are in Northwest Fayetteville on Rutherford Farms, and this is where I live and also where I have placed my business. It's Honed In Knife and Blade Sharpening. I sharpen a variety of tools and scissors and all types of knives, clipper blades. If it cuts, I can get it sharp.
Until recently, Eck operated a shop in Prairie Grove, which he had to vacate.
Well, yeah, we had a brick-and-mortar retail location where we sold, you know, cutlery and handmade knives by Arkansas knife makers and did our sharpening on-site there. And during the course of the pandemic, we were still paying rent and not open for business, so it just became, you know, common sense to close that location. And since I've moved all my equipment into this enclosed trailer here, and I am now have a mobile sharpening operation.
Which he runs with the help of his collie, Sue, as you can hear. Eck hauls his mobile shop to patrons in need of items to be sharpened, or customers are welcome to drop off items at the farm located on Reed Valley Road. Because of the pandemic, he's devised a no-contact system. He gestures to a set of lockers nearby.
Like right behind us here, we have a drop-off locker with drop-off instructions where you can fill out an information form and place your items in a secure locker. And I will come by every day and sharpen them and place them back into that locker. And then the last four, your phone number, will get them out.
Referring to the lock combinations, the mobile sharpening trailer and lockers stand near the entrance of Rutherford Farm, a historic homestead formerly occupied by horticulturalist Carl Todemeyer. Chuck and Donalyn Rutherford grow and sell ornamentals and produce here now.
Chuck Rutherford is the president of the Fayetteville Farmers Market, and that's the Fayetteville Farmers Market is where I started sharpening last year in Fayetteville, and we met there, and that's kind of how I ended up here.
When the farmer's market opens back up on the town square, you'll be able to see Tyler Eck at work. He purchased the business a year ago, February, and has fully outfitted his mobile shop.
So I have two workbenches in my trailer. They have three scissor sharpeners, one bench grinder, a flat hone for clipper blades, and then a very, very nice belt sander for knives.
Eck is on call to sharpen most anything, he says. And although residential business is down due to the pandemic, commercial business has been steady.
Veterinarians and dog groomers and restaurants, barbershops, salons, you know, all these industries have things that cut. Their clipper blades, their scissors, their knives. And so I go there on site and I sharpen them and have them back to them the same exact day.
And because most of us are at home cooking rather than eating out due to social isolation, our culinary tools are likely dull. So Eck demonstrates sharpening a kitchen knife. He first attaches it to a jig.
Yeah, the jig holds the knife in the correct position and in the right angle. So that way, as I slide the knife across the abrasive and I use various different abrasives, the angle is maintained all throughout.
He glides the knife blade across the narrow belt covered with ceramic abrasive, which creates a really cool sound.
And that's the key to any sharpening process. It's forming a burr, maintaining a burr, then honing away that burr.
He uses a second, finer belt.
Mm-hmm. did was just remove the scratches that the previous belt made. We're moving on to another, even finer abrasive.
He wipes the blade with compound cream to remove any shards and scratches and washes it once more in bleach water, dries it, then tests it.
Test cut will be the wrapping paper that we use to wrap it up.
Finally, he demonstrates sharpening a really dull, beat-up 30-year-old pickaxe using a belt sander. And the cost for all these sharp tools?
So knives, to sharpen any knife is $5, and to sharpen any garden tool is $7.
Now fully sharpened, the implement will dig deeper with a lot less effort. Follow Tyler Eck at Honed in NWA on Facebook as well as Instagram at #sharplocal. Get it? Shop local, sharp local. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Arkansas state parks are beginning to slowly welcome back guests. In Mountain View, the Ozark Folk Center is a state park that thrives on music. Usually, the pandemic has quieted the Folk Center and forced cancellation of performances and the Ozark Folk Festival. To try to fill that void, Mountain View-based Stone Bank and the people behind the public radio program Ozark Highlands Radio are teaming up for Cabin Fever 2020, an online concert. Last week, we reached the executive producer of Ozark Highlands Radio, Darren Dorton, at his Mountain View office. He says the concert will be available at cabinfever.stonebank.com on May 28th.
We've pre-recorded a lot of the performances, and we got some availability from the musicians here in Stone County. They submitted performances to us. We chose the ones we thought were really good, and so most of this has sort of been edited and put together beforehand, and so that was the sort of the thought process is we'd gather the material and edit this rather than trying to do what a lot of folks are seeing these days, like with a live Zoom concert or a live stream. You run into a lot of technical difficulties that way. Sometimes the audio isn't as good. So our thought was doing this in a more controlled environment, we'd have a little bit better product that way.
I'm going to ask you about some of the performers that we're going to see and hear in this production. I want to start with the Gravel Yard Bluegrass Band. Their name tells us kind of where they met.
Yeah, that's right. Practicing out in a gravel yard on the square, I believe, is kind of how that all came about. Those are really some of the finest musicians we have here in Stone County and also from the Little Rock area. A couple of the folks I'm familiar with, just because they're here in Stone County, are the bass player Gresham McMillan and the fiddle player Mary Parker. Both Gresham and Mary have been regular figures here in Stone County and at the Ozark Folk Center for a number of years. Grisham's been playing bass here since forever, it seems, and he's involved with all kinds of different bands, but this group has really taken off for them. They've become real popular. Mary Parker, the fiddler, she's been a fiddle champion not only here for Arkansas State, but at a lot of other fiddle contests around our area, and she's just a really, really talented musician, great fiddle player, excellent singer, and both of those musicians are really popular around here, and we really enjoy what they're doing these days.
I think when a lot of people think about Stone County and Mountain View and the Folk Center, they think of people who have a few years with their fiddle or their instrument. But then you have someone like Grace Stormont, who I don't think has that many years. She seems to be someone who is of the younger generation, continuing and adapting a bit the traditional music.
She's really been a bright spot for our young musicians here, along with Mary Parker, and there are many others. But Grace has really taken the music, the history, the tradition, made it her own, and brought it forward in a way that's not only attractive to the older generation, but she's also bringing in a younger audience. She really embraces a lot of the old music and tradition, a lot of the old ballads from Alameda Riddle she sings. She's got a really deep well that she digs from musically, not only traditional folk music from here in the Ozarks, but jazz and more modern folk music from the 60s. And as you'll see when she does this, she's also multi-talented on many instruments, banjo, fiddle, guitar. She plays bass. She's a wonderful singer. And we're just really thrilled that, you know, she's chosen to move to this area just because of the music.
And, of course, there's going to be Mark Jones and Love Holler, the Bowtanglers, a lot of others. I want to highlight, though, a couple of guys who have been in our studio more than once. They're from Northwest Arkansas, Ed Nicholson and Stan Diab, and some great pickers there, too, right?
Yes, indeed, yeah. In fact, one of the things Neil Moore approached me about was, you know, they wanted to do a version of Will the Circle Be Unbroken, and which we thought was a really appropriate way to sort of tie the whole thing together at the end of the show. And they had some connection with those fellas, and what a great way to have them involved and have that song involved as well.
One thing that strikes me about the music that is celebrated at the Folk Center is that it's often music about perseverance, about getting through tough times, and that seems so appropriate right now.
Isn't that the case? And it's funny you mentioned that, too, you know, not to bring up another point, but people have been handling being isolated and working through the pandemic in different ways. And in some ways, it could almost be argued that that's Stone County and this particular region has a history of being isolated from the larger population. That's how a lot of the music developed. It was, you know, for the longest time, there wasn't television or radio here, and those or paved roads, for that matter, as late as the 50s. So that, in a way, has kind of been it's not unusual for those type of things to be normal around here. So I've just noticed myself, personally speaking, of course, you know, things that have changed for a lot of us personally, but how we live our lives day to day here hasn't really changed a whole lot, especially for folks in a rural environment compared to people who are in a suburban area.
Darren, thank you so much for your time. Be well, and we look forward to hearing you on the radio.
Thank you, Kyle. Thanks for the call.
Darren Dorton is executive producer of Ozark Highlands Radio, produced in Mountain View, and heard on more than 130 radio stations, including KUAF, every Saturday evening at 6. Stone Bank, also based in Mountain View and a major sponsor of Ozark Highlands Radio, is teaming up with the show and the Ozark Folk Center for Cabin Fever 2020. The concert will be available at cabinfever.stonebank.com beginning May 28th at 7:30 and archived on the Stone Bank YouTube channel. And normally around this time of the year, hundreds of University of Arkansas students would be gearing up to depart for study abroad programs, but not this year. Due to the coronavirus, the university has suspended all international exchange for the summer. The university's satellite campus in Rome, however, is still offering a chance for students to get a study abroad experience, albeit virtually. Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth reports.
In late February, as the initial cases of COVID-19 were identified throughout the United States, university students across the globe were being told to return home. Italy, one of the most popular destinations for study abroad programs, quickly became the epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak in Europe. At this point, Francesco Badeschi, the University of Arkansas Rome Center director, had only been in his position for about 6 months.
The first challenge that I have to face in my new position was exactly this unprecedented and unexpected situation.
Suddenly, he says he was tasked with shutting down the Rome campus and getting nearly 100 students home safely.
So the most difficult thing at the beginning was to, first of all, communicate with the students, explain them what was going on, face their, of course, you know, disappointment that this experience was coming to an end, and help them to get on an aircraft and go back, making sure that everybody was following our recommendation.
And now with all of his students spread across the world, Badeschi says he and the Rome Center staff had to find a way to make their classes accessible online.
But some of them had to go back to China, India. We had two students who went to Saudi Arabia. So suddenly we had to deal with 6 hours plus or minus compared to us.
But even more complicated was finding a way to make study abroad courses, which are rooted in a physical place, equally as enriching from a computer screen.
You know, online teaching has been around for forever. But for us, I mean, given that the specific nature of the study abroad program was totally new. Most of our courses are design-oriented, architecture, fashion design. So they have a lot of hands-on component. In other words, you know, architects draw, fashion designers, they have to, you know, sew. So, for example, we had to give our faculty some computers that they can use, big tablets. So they could sketch on the screen, and so students could see wherever they were in the world, see what the instructor was drawing on their screens. Our fashion designer was amazing. She created a kind of structure in her home so she can put her camera while she was sewing and cutting the fabrics, and then the students could see live what she was doing.
Badeschi says with some help from the university's global campus back in Arkansas, this crash course in engaging students through technology sparked an idea. If students can't come to Rome this summer, why not bring Rome to the students?
We were expecting to receive about 150 students starting next week. Now with the COVID-19, all the international trips have been canceled, so no students can travel. That's why we decided to offer these virtual courses. We're trying to offer through, you know, interviews to people, to recordings of our professors going on these specific sites, deep immersion into the Italian and the local culture, which includes a little bit of language, a little bit of, you know, food, history, fashion. You know, if you want, it's a sort of, you know, deep immersion around the topic of Made in Italy.
Buongiorno and greetings from Rome, Italy. Today we are in front of the Colosseum.
That's Badeschi on his bike in front of the Colosseum for a video that he recorded earlier this week. The center has already posted a few videos like this, with faculty acting as tour guides, on their Facebook page. For the 3 virtual courses this summer, Badeschi says they're trying to use technology in more interactive ways than a traditional online class.
So, of course, there will be content, there will be, you know, placed on the usual tools like Blackboard or other platforms. But then we're trying to use, for example, StreamYard, which allows live interaction. It's almost like a TV channel where students become part of the show and they can talk directly with the professor, with the speaker, so they can answer live questionnaires and they see in real time the answers to their questions. You know, so that's the interactive component that we're trying to implement in these courses.
Sarah Malloy, the university's director of study abroad and international exchange, says while moving study abroad from a place to a screen has been unusual, it's a necessity right now that her office is looking to explore more broadly.
Beyond the virtual courses that are offered at the Rome Center this summer, we are also exploring virtual international internships, and we believe that these virtual international internships are a way to give students real-world experience and in a place-bound fashion, but it's going to be, these virtual internships are very project-based, based on the needs of any number of multinational corporations. And so we've been relying on our external program partners to help give our students other virtual opportunities.
Badeski says the Rome Center is planning to reopen as a hybrid course, part virtual, part experiential, at a later date this fall. But he is certain that the coronavirus will have a lasting impact on the Rome campus and international study for a while.
We have to coexist. In my opinion, we have to coexist with this new situation. Definitely, we will have an impact on how many people can sit in our classroom. So we'll have to work about, you know, work with new scheduling. For instance, if we cannot take public transportation or if that is too risky, we will have to redesign which kind of site visits we're going to do. You know, and this may have an impact on how many things you can see, or we have to, you know, hire a private bus, which will make add some extra cost to the program. Housing is an issue, you know. So these are open questions that we are analyzing right now.
While the university's study abroad programs are on hold for the summer, Malloy says the office is taking steps to resume programs with some precautions in the fall semester.
Beyond hosting like a virtual pre-departure orientation, we've also had to shift some of our deadlines for students for this fall semester. So typically we'd have an April deadline. We've shifted that back to June 1st. And so we're working on just calling all of our students and touching base with them and answering any questions that they've got as part of our contingency planning to help just put students at the center of this.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Daniel Carruth.
And on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large, we continue our Business as Unusual series with Bentonville-based Hillfolk. We'll find out what the retailer has discovered during this time. And Raven Cook will bring us a new Reflections in Black. That and much more on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 p.m. on 91.3 KUAF.
Anxiety and depression magnify the impact of the pandemic for children.
It's harder for me to find joy in little moments.
Therapists say parents can help.
We are going to have to create, as parents, structures that usually other people do.
Managing kids' mental health needs on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition tomorrow morning from 5 to 9 on 91.3 KUAF. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Drake's Creek. 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Contributors to tonight's episode included Antoinette Grajeda, Zuzana Sitek, who gave us information about the Fayetteville Housing Authority Garden, Jacqueline Froelich, and Daniel Carruth. Tonight's show mastered by Timothy Dennis. We will be back tomorrow at noon with a brand new edition of Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks for listening.